You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we'll talk to the author of a new book on insubordination, about the best ways to rock the boat at work and beyond. First, Wisconsin had more than 300 homicides last year. That's a 70% increase from 2019. Law enforcement agents say there are too many guns on the streets. Some politicians are using the deaths as talking points. Corrine Hess has more.
Torando Long used to spend his mornings taking long walks around his Kenosha neighborhood. His sister, Ramonda Thomas, says exercise brought him joy. Long turned 28 on Valentine's Day, 2021. For his birthday, his mom and sister gave him new workout clothes and a pair of headphones. He was wearing the gifts the next morning when he was shot 3 times in the stomach during his daily walk. Thomas believes her brother thought he was being asked for directions.
He always walked early in the day. It's never like late at night or anything like that, so I don't think he worried about anything.
Long's death was Kenosha's first homicide of 2021. The city ended the year with 16 murders, up from 6 in 2019. That increase was reflected statewide. Kenosha police believe Long was the victim of mistaken identity when he was gunned down. Kenosha's interim police chief, Eric Larson, says guns have become the fallback in arguments leading to more deaths.
And we've seen that in many circumstances, whether it be at taverns, on the street, all these different locations, including some of the domestics.
For Thomas, her brother's death changed the way she thinks about her hometown.
We know now that we can't, like, live in a world where you can go anywhere and be anywhere at any time because you can be walking down the street and get killed at 9 in the morning. Then you're not really safe.
Wisconsin had 315 homicides last year. About 200 of those were in Milwaukee County. And this year is already off to a deadly start. By February 22nd, Milwaukee County had already seen 38 homicides. Last year's 38th homicide was recorded on April 11th. Some politicians, now in the throes of campaigning, are turning the statistics into talking points. Milwaukee's acting mayor, Cavalier Johnson, would like to see a portion of the state's $2.9 billion budget surplus used to address Milwaukee's challenges with public safety. But that's unlikely. Governor Tony Evers says he has directed $45 million in COVID federal aid to local governments for public safety. He pushed the issue to the Republican-led legislature and called for an increase to shared revenue payments to municipalities.
We've had great trouble with the Republicans getting shared revenue increased in the state. That's the money that those municipalities use to do their work, including fire and police protection.
But some people have felt desperate and lacked confidence in police. That's why University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee criminologist Theodore Lentz says he would have been surprised if there had not been an increase in violence in the last 2 years.
We kind of had the perfect storm. We had the COVID-19 pandemic, and when you couple that with the massive amount of social unrest that we had with the protests and, you know, additional incidents, police shootings and things like that, that just kind of kept that sparks thriving.
Criminologists like Lentz don't have an exact answer about why the crime wave of the 1990s slowed, and they don't know what will make this spike in homicides go down.
It's thinking, too, about, well, you know, who's at the highest risk for violence? You know, if we see some positive changes, are they part of that positive change?
Back at the Thomas home, Long's memory lives on in photos scattered across the living room.
He was really big in our family because, you know, he was the firstborn.
It's a February afternoon, but the family's Christmas tree is still up. Thomas says her brother loved the holiday.
He came and wrapped all of our gifts. We kind of hold on to that.
Homicides are trending up this year again. And unless something changes, there will be even more families like this across Wisconsin trying to keep memories like these alive. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, do you get along to get ahead at work or in life? Do you try not to make waves, or are you willing to rock the boat? Our next guest says we should be more willing to be the odd one out and raise questions about the way we do things. Without rebellion, without questioning, without dissent, he says society stagnates. We don't move forward. But he also says people who take on that role can get a bad rap, and that can keep others from doing the good work of principled insubordination. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Does this sound like you? Are you the one at the workplace, at the committee meeting, whatever it might be, who raises concerns, questions why you do things the way you do them? Do you get a good response when you do that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Todd Kashdan is a professor of psychology at George Mason University in Northern Virginia and an expert on the psychology of well-being, psychological strengths, mental agility, and social relationships. His new book is called The Art of Insubordination, How to Dissent and Defy Effectively. Todd, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, so great to be here.
Why do we need insubordinate people? Why do we need these principled insubordinates?
I think you only have to look at history to know the importance of having someone that dissents from popular sentiments at the time. You go back to the Victorian era, and every book that was a bestseller was about etiquette, and everyone talked about family, and the idea of having a romantic relationship because you were in love was absurd. And then Sigmund Freud pops on the scene and says, you know what? Romance is one of the fundamental reasons why men engage in creative pursuits. And then you've got Martin Luther King and Malcolm X that are saying, you know what? There's no reason that if you're black, you should be treated differently than someone that's white. And then you've got 10 years of revolution. And then all of a sudden you move from, you can be in the military and give up your life and 10 years, but you can't publicly reveal that you're not heterosexual, and 10 years later you end up having gay marriage is acceptable. You dissenters speed up the evolution of norms in society.
You write, though, that it isn't just being a rebel without a cause, rejecting authority for authority's sake. You throw that word principled insubordination. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, the fundamental part of that is, is this your authentic, genuine value system, or is it because you're looking to get likes and approval by the groups that you're a member of or aspire to be a part of? A lot of people, they're saying something publicly that they don't even believe in. It's actually one of the hardest things about living in society, particularly America right now, is the media gives you an idea what is the popular common belief, but it's often those barroom conversations, those barbecues around the fire pit where the real story is told. And because of that, we don't often understand that most people tend to be very good critical thinkers and really don't believe in the extremes of any of these political parties. And most people are very rational and think about their family's income, the price of gas, the price of food, and make sure that they're not paying more taxes than they need to. And most people who are Democrat or Republican tend to be very similar in their viewpoints.
When you talk about at the very best being maybe ostracized within their social group or ignored, your book is a cookbook, you describe it, of how to do this, how to dissent in whatever your group is in a way that can actually make a difference. What are some of the main points that we want to start with? I think something's going wrong, say, in my organization. I want to bring it up. How do I start?
Great. So if you're talking about your organization, even if it's your family business, the number one strategy that I would say is what I call idiosyncrasy credits. This is from 1967. It's the idea that over the time that you're working in an organization, you do the dirty work. You get lunch for people, you go to the meetings, you are part of committees, and you build up currency over the course of time that shows you're a good team member, such that you now have something you can spend when you disagree with where the organization is going or how an authority member or a team member is treating you or someone else. So you build up what's called idiosyncrasy credits, which means that now you can deviate from the group because you've already established with the track record that you can do something. And when you first share an idea that deviates from everyone else and is going to potentially shock or intrigue people, you want to make a note to remind everyone that here are the things you've done, here are your years of service, here's your commitment to the group. Show your tattoo of the logo of the company on your left tricep. And then when you do the reveal about what you think is going wrong or where you should go, people are like, oh, okay, I'm going to trust Jane or Jack because, listen, they're one of us. You want to establish you're one of the group, you're not an outsider.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jennifer is with us in Madison. Jennifer, hi.
Hi there. As soon as you started describing this, I knew you were talking about me. I have been called a wrecking ball. I've been called a firecracker. I'm not sure whether it's part of my neurodivergence or, but I kind of say that I was born without chill. And I am always looking to really refine ideas. And that can be, from anybody from, someone who would be my political nemesis, somebody who's across the table from me, or somebody who is cooperative, somebody who I want us all to do better. And I've often remarked that it's a difficult place to be, especially as a woman. In this society, but I can't do anything else. This is somehow I was born this way, the same way other people maybe were born to be people pleasers. And I haven't found really that people find it too abrasive. Obviously some people do, but I think most people see that my heart's in the right place.
Jennifer, I got to ask, how did you cultivate that? How do you convey that your heart's in the right place so you're not just, getting in fights with people?
How I'm not just bulldozing people? one of the ways that I do that is that I engage in a lot of charitable acts. I raise money for people who are in bad situations. I do a lot of building up of other people as well, and a lot of just emotional support of people. I think that's really important these days. And I try, are you there?
Oop, your line's breaking up a little bit, Jennifer, but you gave us a lot to work with, Todd. I mean, Jennifer could have been a chapter in your book, I think.
No, Jennifer, I'm so glad that you called in first because, first of all, when we think about someone that's a principled rebel, the typical thing is to imagine a male who's loud and assertive and not a woman. So this is your superpower, Jen. This is your strength. I'm actually going to give a phrase to actually describe what you are. You are a counterpoint, which is when the group is going in one direction, you recognize, you pause, take a deliberate pause and say, you know what? I care about the health and longevity of this group so much so that I'm willing to put skin in the game and risk my reputation and my stress level because I want to share something that I think we could do even better and we can actually be stronger because of it. And one thing you heard that Jennifer says is that, and you can see from the inflection of her voice, like she cares. And that's a very important thing we have to remember. Most principled dissenters, they're not doing it because they're trying to gain power. They're doing it because the group matters so much to them. And one of the important things that she said was, is that if you observe her behavior and ignore her words, you're going to see, oh, this is a virtuous person. This is somebody I want my side, even though she's going to cause a little bit of tension in the air because she's going to disrupt the harmony and the positivity of the group and make us inefficient in the short term. Because she's going to make us think about innovative ideas that will help us in the long term.
Jennifer, thanks for that call. We're talking to psychology professor Todd Kashdan about his new book, The Art of Insubordination, How to Dissent and Defy Effectively. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you caused more or less of a stir over time in your workplace or wherever? Have you stood your ground in maybe a workplace meeting or something like that where you were going against the prevailing wisdom? How did it go? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk with George Mason University psychology professor Todd Kashdan. His new book is called The Art of Insubordination, How to Dissent and Defy Effectively. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Superior. Hey, Jeff.
Good afternoon. I'm a Green Bay Packer shareholder, and over 20 years ago, I stood up at a Packer shareholder meeting in front of 18,000 people, and I disagreed with what Reggie White was saying before the Wisconsin State Legislature about gay marriage and the gay agenda and stuff. I encouraged Bob Harlan and the Packer organization to distance themselves from Reggie White's comments because he doesn't represent the Packers when he speaks. But the prevailing opinion among Packer shareholders and the administration was that, well, he has a right to his opinion, but he was using Packer uniform, Packer stationery and communication and stuff. And I was vindicated 2 weeks after the shareholder meeting because the Packers eventually apologized to the NFL and the Human Rights Campaign and did distance themselves from what Reggie White was saying. But it was, I took a lot of flack right away.
Did you feel nervous getting up in front of a bunch of Packer fans and saying, hey, distance yourself from a future Hall of Famer?
Well, I love Reggie White. He prayed for me, and I'm no longer in that lifestyle. So I think the irony is he did change my life. But I'm glad I stood up and spoke from my heart because I love the Packers more than I love anything else, really.
Jeff, thanks a lot. Let's take that last point there, Todd. He loves the organization, so he's willing to criticize it in that moment.
That's right. And here's the thing is Jeff was really clear that he was going to sacrifice his psychological well-being for the care and concern of the group and the notion of for one individual to say that their moral views represent this entire heterogeneous group of people. Jeff said, no, like you don't represent all of us. We are a diverse number of people that's here. And he had a problem with that. I think there should be more Jeffs in the world. It doesn't matter whether you agree with Jeff on the issue. What's important about it, about dissenters that we know, is if even if the dissenter is wrong, just the fact that a Jeff says something means that everyone thinks about, huh, what's the evidence for the view that I'm holding deeply onto? What's the evidence for the other side? And what have I not considered? Even if they disagree with Jeff on that day, as he mentioned, a few days later, he was vindicated. And this is something that's really important. You might know ahead of time that in the immediate mention of your dissenting idea, probably people disagree with you and dig their heels. But you've gotten a little bit of a message into their brain, a little tiny worm that entered their brain, which is, you know what? There's another way of looking at this, another vantage point, and it makes people more creative in their decision making.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. Walt joins us now in Fort Atkinson. Walt, hi.
Good afternoon. It's an interesting topic. So I've got you on speaker. I think this will work.
Hey,
I just wanted to get the comment on the concept of the first follower and the importance of the first follower. There was a video that was popular on YouTube a year or two ago, and it showed an outdoor concert, and this guy got up and started dancing out in the lawn on the grass, and he was dancing wildly, and he was kind of scared everybody because he was so crazy. But then another guy got up and started dancing and broke that ice, and pretty soon half of the entire crowd was out dancing to this thing. And the importance of the first follower validating the leader was the topic of that.
Interesting. Walt, thanks for the call. We don't have too much time left. Todd, the first follower idea.
Walt is speaking of a very interesting video that everyone should watch. There's the myth of the lone genius. Is you can't do this alone. Your voice has to be amplified by finding people that are going to be in your alliance and coalition. It's the first thing you should do in an organization. If you're Jeff and you're an organization, if you're Jen, where she's just a firecracker, find other people, because when you speak your message as a consistent whole unit, it is harder to immediately dismiss you, and your ideas have to at least be given a fair hearing. And all you could ask for as a minority voice of not having the numbers or power is that you get a fair hearing and people consider your message. You need that alliance.
Thanks for that call, Walt. I want to flip things around, as you do in your book, Todd, and talk about how organizations can be more dissent-friendly, because they can get a lot of value out of it.
Yeah, there's a couple things that are important. One, the leader should always speak last and preferably never give their opinion in public on the issue that people are debating. The best strategies that we know are not brainstorming sessions, which is what most organizations do, but have people anonymously write down their ideas so that when people look at the ideas, the messages, they're not attaching it to how much you like the messenger. And in this way, the newcomer, the only black person in an organization, the women in the organization, the people that are physically unattractive in the organization and aren't cool, quote unquote cool in the organization, their ideas are treated with just as much merit as those people who are socially attractive and with power. And the another idea that's important is that you should clarify in an organization that the goal of trying to make a decision as a group is not to be harmonious or have cohesion and feel good about yourselves. There's always time for happy hour later. When you're working together, critical thinking, independent thinking, and having a little bit of healthy skepticism, encourage it, incentivize it, and make sure people share their criticisms while you're in the room and not having the small little breakout sessions where people are talking smack after the meeting happens.
All right, 30-second drill. I'm in a meeting. Somebody's raising concerns about the organization. I feel defensive and uncomfortable about it. How do I shake that and give them a fair hearing?
One of the most important things is to what's called self-distancing, which is that you imagine that the regret of not considering an idea, your future self, will be more upset than the regret of actually being embarrassed that you chose the wrong direction by listening to someone. We should always try to imagine what would we think 1 year from now if we didn't give this idea a chance, because we know that the world is constantly changing. We know there's constant flux. So we have to remind ourselves to expand the time horizon and not think just about our immediate defensive reaction, but that we know that we don't want to be the next Kodak. We don't want to be the next Blockbuster. We don't want to be the next Beanie Baby. And so we, in order to prevent that from happening, we have to have a reservoir of new ideas that come into our possession. We play with them. We tinker with them, we explore them, and maybe we throw them out. But we have to bring those ideas into the resource center.
Todd, thanks for joining us today.
Great to be here.
That's Todd Kashdan, psychologist at George Mason University. His new book is The Art of Insubordination, How to Dissent and Defy Effectively. This is the Ideas Network. If you do anything online, chances are companies are collecting a lot of data about you. A new Wisconsin bill aims to give you more control over that data. Under the bill, you'd be able to ask for some of it to be deleted. And the proposed law would let you block the sale of your data, and you could keep it from being used for targeted advertising. The bill is known as the Wisconsin Data Privacy Act. It recently passed the state assembly. But some consumer advocates say the bill takes an industry-friendly approach to data privacy. One concern, they say the law requires you to opt out of targeted advertising and data sales instead of having to opt in to allow those things. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want something like this, a way to have more control over what companies do with the data they collect when you do anything online? Would you take the option of blocking targeted ads, keeping your data from being sold from one company to another if you had the option? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Shannon Zimmerman is the bill's sponsor. He's a Republican representative from River Falls, representing the 30th State Assembly District. Representative Zimmerman, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, it is my sincere pleasure, and thank you for raising this very important topic.
Can you give us some more of the basics? What would this bill do?
Well, so first of all, just a quick intro to this. You know, I've spent 25 years building a technology business in the heart of Wisconsin, and so have had a front row seat to all the great things that tech can bring us, but also, if left unchecked, some of the potential challenges that can be introduced. So my motivation was pretty simple. I think in its most basic form, Wisconsin residents, Americans in general, should have the following expectations. You should be able to ask a data collector, what do you have on me? What information have you collected? I'm interested to know what you've got. Number two, to whom have you sold or shared that information with, right? So where's my data? Who's all got it? And then third and finally, as you indicated on the intro here, you can say no, stop, delete it. I don't feel comfortable, or I'd like to exit from that program at this point in time. So those are the three basic things that my bill will do.
So if I'm a consumer, if this bill is signed into law, on a practical level, what would I have to do to request that information, obtain it, and have it deleted if I want to?
So in other states and nations, for example, Europe has a version of this, has a far more advanced, called the GDPR, Global Data Protection Regulation. But the premise is pretty simple, right? A consumer can reach out. Most companies would have a form on their webpage or have a call-in number. A consumer reaches out and said, hey, my name is Shannon Zimmerman, and I'd like to know what you have on me. Now, the consumer is required to provide proof of identity so that, I can't go in and look up somebody else's information. And once they do that, then the data collector would have, just over a month to then, collect that information and get that back over to them.
Now, I know the names of a lot of websites. I might search for something on Google. I might post something on Facebook, whatever. So I know I could go to them and ask for this data. There are also a lot of data collection companies that I've never heard of, I'm guessing. How do I track them down and see what data they have on me?
So the bill is intended to almost follow the web of connections here, because whomever is collecting data on you, and if they have transferred or sold it, they have to also provide that information so that you can accurately identify who has that. And for example, if you say to that data collector, hey, I'm going to exercise my third right in this bill, which is to remove it, they would then pass along notification to those that they have provided it to. So, there is a mechanism in here to try and run that down. And to your point, Rob, the data broker industry, which is an industry probably most people aren't familiar with, this is a multi-billion-dollar industry right now. It's people who've built businesses solely on selling information.
We're talking to Representative Shannon Zimmerman, a sponsor of a new bill on data privacy in the Wisconsin Assembly. He's a Republican representative from River Falls. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Lisa is with us in Amberg. Lisa, hi.
Hi. I used to donate quite a bit to different organizations, but it seemed like every time I did, they sold my name to some other organization, and all of a sudden I'm being bombarded with insurance or politics or some sort of sales pitches. And I've quit. I've actually stopped donating money to different places or different organizations, specifically because I don't want to be on a mailing list somewhere. And it has slowed down the information that I keep getting that I don't want. But it hasn't stopped it.
Lisa, thanks for the call. Representative Zimmerman, would your bill help Lisa maybe figure out where that information was coming from and how to stop the flow so she could start donating again?
Well, Lisa actually gave a fantastic example of what happens there. So let's imagine for a moment that I am an avid sportsman. I enjoy hunting pheasants, and so I make donations to, Pheasants Unlimited or whatever, right? Okay. Other organizations, maybe in other sporting areas, might go, well, if he donated there, maybe he'll donate to Ducks Unlimited or whatever, the cause is. So the example Lisa gave is exactly what's happening here, is that you have one organization which you made a donation to. They perhaps have sold that information to others who are interested, and they will market to you. And in this bill, there are some qualifications, some minimum criteria here that have to be met. But in general, the premise of the bill would allow Lisa to say, nope, don't send that anymore, or stop it, or delete it. I mean, you can kind of tell them what you want to do there, but that would be one outcome that would be favorable under this bill.
Lisa, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Scott now in Menominee. Scott, hi.
Hey, how you doing? I was wondering, for as far as data collection goes, also this is, I'm thinking, demographics. Is this going to include keeping government from knowing too much about you? Like, your voter ID laws, do they know how tall I am, what color my eyes are, or is it kind of a government gets the monopoly on your information but no one else?
Scott, thanks for the call. Representative Zimmerman, does this affect government agencies at all?
Yeah. Now, data collectors are data collectors, Scott, and whether private or public. Now there's a couple caveats to that. A government would use certain information on you, for example, criminal records and criminal histories. That is outside of the scope of this bill, because probably for public safety, we all would agree we wouldn't want people's records being deleted. So there's certain types of information that would be, out of bounds. However, any private, and really that's what we're going after here, folks. We're going after your personal personal private information. You know, many people subscribe to various loyalty programs because they want, you know, they buy X product and they want to know when it's on sale. That's great. This bill doesn't hamper that. But whether it's government, Scott, or private sector, if, you know, if they're selling your data and you don't feel comfortable, you can say no.
Thanks for that call, Scott. A couple of concerns raised in testimony, Representative Zimmerman. One from business groups, including Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, the idea that if every state is coming up with its own twist on this kind of law, and I'm doing business, my website doesn't end at a state boundaries, am I suddenly complying with 50 plus D.C.? You know, is this going to be too many different laws? Shouldn't this be tackled at the federal level?
You know, WMC does a great job for all the businesses across the state of Wisconsin. And in theory, I don't disagree with their point. This should be taken up at the federal level. But as I also said in testimony, very candidly, little progress, if any, happens at the federal level these days. And so, you know, we can't wait any longer. I mean, this is a serious, serious matter. I mean, data is power. I mean, you know, understanding what moves and motivates someone, what articles they read, how long their eyes stay on certain images. When you understand that, you know, and you apply artificial intelligence to it, suddenly you could do some pretty serious things in terms of moving people from their position. So I don't disagree in theory with WMC in this one, but I feel that waiting for that to happen puts Wisconsin residents in harm's way, and I wanted to step up for Wisconsin residents here.
And then some consumer groups have raised the concern that this doesn't go far enough. The presumption under this law would still be you get to do whatever you want with my data unless I come and tell you not to. They're saying, why not? You can't do stuff with my data unless I come and say you can do it. Opt in instead of opt out. What do you say to that?
Yeah. again, probably in theory I would be okay with that, but let's think about that. If I took the reverse approach, which, you know, again, I'm not opposed to thinking that way, that would literally flip some of the largest tech companies who are really advertising companies upside down. And so I would rather make progress and take good steps forward than none at all, because I, you know, the concern that I have and with some of the research that I did is if you take the alternative approach, which, again, it's well-intended. I know why they're asking for it. We run the risk of getting nothing done, and the opposition would be enormous at this point. So I'm satisfied with just people being able to see and understand what do these data collectors have on me, who they share or sold it to, and I have the ability to say no. That's a major step forward for Wisconsin, and we have examples in some other states where that basic premise has been achieved.
Representative Zimmerman, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That's Shannon Zimmerman, Republican representing the state's 30th Assembly District, with us today for a look at a bill he's sponsoring known as the Wisconsin Data Privacy Act. Up next, we'll talk to a data privacy expert about wider issues surrounding our data and her thoughts on the bill, some of the trade-offs that come with stricter data protection. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you had the choice. Would you want less of your data collected and sold amongst companies, for example? What if that made life a little more difficult? Your search functions were starting from ground zero every time, from square one, clunkier searches, ads that have nothing to do with you. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about data privacy and a new Wisconsin bill that aims to give people more control over their data. That bill recently passed the state assembly. We just heard from the sponsor. You can still join in with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your own experiences with data privacy or lack of it, or your questions about what they're doing with all that info about you. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Nadine Kozak joins us now. She's an associate professor in the School of Information Studies at UW-Milwaukee. Nadine, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Can you give us a sense of exactly how much data companies are collecting on us and what they do with it all?
Companies are collecting all kinds of data from, you know, the things that we're much more, we think about much more, like what we search for, things that we like on social media, products that we buy, but they're also using cookies to see where else we're searching online. You know, they're sharing and selling data so that they get information from other places that we visit and sell and do business with. So they're really collecting pretty much anything you can think of, both from your smartphone, from your computer, and then also from the things that you actually do online when you're paying your bills or shopping or whatever it is that you're doing.
We just heard about this bill in Wisconsin, one effort. A lot of people have different approaches to try to tackle this issue. What do you make of this attempt here in Wisconsin?
You know, I like the idea of having state privacy laws. As Representative Zimmerman said, there's not been much movement at the federal level. And surveys tell us that, you know, across party lines, approximately 80-some-odd percent, 82-83% of Democrat and Republican voters would like Congress to look at consumer privacy law. But they're also, you know, 70-some-odd percent of voters would like states to do it if Congress won't. So it's definitely a step in the right direction. And a lot of states, there's currently proposals in 26 states and the District of Columbia about consumer privacy. So we're certainly, and, you know, people are very concerned about this. And my thoughts on the law in general is, we do need a stronger consumer privacy law. I think, you know, we should take very seriously some of the concerns that this bill might not go far enough. You talked about some of those concerns. And there are others as well. For example, there's no provision in the bill to let consumers sue for violations of their privacy. So the bill could actually go further than it does.
Let's talk about the downsides a little bit more. I mean, yeah, it's a little spooky sometimes when I get ads for, you know, restaurant chains that I actually eat at. Like, I get the sense that they know me. That doesn't seem too bad, though. What are some of the worries? What are some of the worst case uses you see of all of our data going into the hands of these companies?
The worst cases. I mean, it depends. This really depends a lot on values, because some people don't want that to be tracked at all, mm-hmm. right? They like their search to be served just for, you know, whatever it is they're doing, and not have this big profile about them and everything that they've done. And especially if we think about in terms, you know, being an academic, I think a lot about intellectual privacy and the ability, you know, we have platforms and search engines that have beautiful records of everything I've searched for this week, which maps nicely onto my thinking.
And you've also worried that there could be trade-offs to companies using less of our data sometimes, like, you know, when I'm searching on certain websites, they know my past searches. They know the kind of stuff I'm looking for that might actually help me. Am I going to lose some of that if there are these restrictions in place?
Well, absolutely, because if you sign up, if you say opt out of targeted advertising, you know, you might not get content that's as directly related to you, which of course can make you take more time to find things that you're interested in, because your searches might not be as personalized as they were before. So that's definitely one concern. And I mean, some people won't opt out, if the law gets passed, they won't opt out so that the companies can use their data. So there are definitely costs to this that, you know, time, energy, and that's also true of having to opt out, because, you know, consumers who don't want to have this information at companies, they're going to have to take the time to go through and figure out how to opt out on each site. And so that'll take time, too. So it's taking, regardless of what you do here, you're spending time.
We're talking to Nadine Kozak, associate professor in the School of Information Studies at UW-Milwaukee, looking at our data privacy. When we do anything online, or very often offline too, for that matter, it ends up in the same place. A lot of data in the hands of the companies we work with, in the hands of companies they sell that data to. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Jake is with us now in Appleton. Jake, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me. My question is involving the European Union's deployment of the global data policy requirements, I think several years back. Can you share kind of some of the genesis of what we learned from having them go through that process? I mean, is accountability being driven? Are there certain things that were identified after going live with it? Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Jake. Nadine, have you been tracking the results of European policies on data privacy?
Somewhat. And I mean, there's definitely things that we can see that have worked very, very well. For example, if you are signing up to a social media site nowadays, you'll notice that there are actually two different terms of services, one for customers in the United States and other places on the planet, and then a limited agreement for European users because they have stronger protections for their privacy. So that's, I mean, big companies have had to listen to that and follow those protections. So we can very clearly see that it is working. And, you know, it would be wonderful to get something like that here from my perspective. But as we know, we haven't been able to do that at the federal level.
Jake, thanks a lot for that call. Nadine, I think sometimes people are counseled, given that we don't really have laws on data privacy, you know, be careful what you do, what you put on the Internet. It seems like it's easier said than done, because if we want to participate in the online world in any way, we have to click the terms of service or we don't get to play. Like, is there much we can, as individuals, that we can actually do?
There's not a lot. As you said, it's unrealistic to expect that people aren't going to be involved online and aren't going to be sharing data because you can't participate, you know, whether be it in online education or buying things online or using social media. So being citizens and consumers require us to, you know, to share this data and to create accounts all over the place. And that's actually one thing that would be a good way to deal with this consumer privacy issue is to minimize data collected. So have strong statutes that say, you know, companies can't collect this or that unless it's necessary to what's actually happening. But of course, this problematizes things like personalized search. And of course, it would make it harder to have these big data profiles about people. But so minimizing data collected by companies would certainly be something to help us as we navigate our online lives every day.
Is it too late for that in some ways? They've already got a lot of that data. Even if we pass the law tomorrow, we can't make that go away, can we?
Well, you would need that in addition to something like the current bill being considered in the Wisconsin legislature, because you could opt out of some of the data collection that has already been stored about you. So they work together. So basically, you could get rid of, delete some of the data already collected. And then if companies had to minimize the data collected going forward, that would keep less data out there about all of us. But, you know, it's a big thing to ask, and it is unpopular. Obviously, as Representative Zimmerman said, there are different companies that make their money based on this data.
Apart from that limitation of what kinds of data companies could collect, if a lawmaker came to you and said, hey, what should be in our data privacy legislation? What would be at the top of your list? Gotta be there.
At this point, I think I would love to see a private right of action, so letting consumers sue for violations of their privacy. For example, in Illinois, they have a Biometric Information Privacy Act, or BIPA. It was passed way back in 2008, and this allows consumers, users, to sue over damages. So in those cases, for example, there have been class action settlements, where they were class action lawsuits, which turned into settlements against Facebook and TikTok, both in 2021. And these settlements, the Facebook one was $650 million, and TikTok was $92 million, because consumers were allowed to sue when a company violated collected and used their biometric facial recognition without their permission.
So that seems like something, just briefly, even if one state is doing it, if they're paying out that kind of settlement, it might be an incentive for companies to not do it anywhere?
Absolutely. Facebook retired in December of 2021. They retired their facial recognition software system that they were using, partly because of this BIPA settlement.
Nadine, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That's Nadine Kozak. She's an associate professor in the School of Information Studies at UW-Milwaukee. She was with us today to talk about a new Wisconsin data privacy bill that recently passed the state assembly. Earlier, we heard from that bill's sponsor, Republican State Representative Shannon Zimmerman.